This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
This week on Hangar Talk, the FAA gets serious about remote drone ID.
And there's a new AD proposed for Tamarack Atlas winglets.
We do a practice routine for the National GA flyover.
And the FAA publishes new mental health guidelines.
Lastly, the Vans bankruptcy saga looks to be coming to an end.
Ian, are you ready to do some Hangar Talk?
Let's do it, David.
From AOPA, your freedom to fly. This is Hangar Talk.
1056, turn right, heading 130, contact final 132.4.
Turn right, contact 3.
With your hosts, Ian Twombly and David Tulitz. This is Hangar Talk.
Welcome to Hangar Talk, everybody. I'm Ian Twombly.
And I'm David Tulitz.
David, our guests are two really cool guys, very accomplished. They have built Hats biplanes together, each one individually, right?
Yep.
But they helped each other. Carlos Siliers and Rick Van Lane, they're locals to us and master craftsmen, really.
Yeah, we're going to hear all about their Hats biplanes. Just a reminder to our listeners, Carlo, who's our ace mechanic and often referred to as the airplane whisperer, he won a bronze Lindy Award for that red Hats biplane at last year's Air Venture.
Beautiful airplane. Yep, absolutely. So we'll, in a few minutes, hear about kind of how they work together and what it was like building them. But for now, let's talk about the news. And starting off with the remote drone ID, which I know is important to you, David, because we talked about this a couple months ago where this FAA rule is final now. Everyone, any drone over 0.55 pounds, which is very light, has to have this remote drone ID technology. The FAA put a little bit of a stay on enforcement for that.
Enforcement, right, yeah. Right. Lack of enforcement. They did not enforce potential violations.
Yep. And that's over. Done.
Yeah, it is as of the middle of March. And as y'all listen to this Hangar Talk broadcast, a real simple rule of thumb is this. If your drone must be registered with the FAA, it probably needs to have a remote ID. Okay. And now there are exceptions like there always are, but generally most commercial drones that you can buy from Amazon, Best Buy, et cetera, if they're built after about September of 2022, they're going to most likely contain that remote ID compliant hardware already in the drone. You have to register yourself and your drone. And that's the bottom line. It's not real hard to do.
Okay.
But if a drone was purchased before December of 2022, now again, that's 2 years ago, that's the month that the FAA began enforcing remote ID compliance with UAS manufacturers, then owners can check with the FAA via their website and just double check and make sure that your model is properly equipped.
Okay, so you just said something that was interesting. I'm pretty ignorant on the drone stuff. So does the FAA, I guess they classify drones and drone operators just like they do sort of pilots and aircraft. So that you can own a drone, I guess, and not be you don't necessarily need a drone certificate if you're not flying commercially, right?
No, if you're a recreational drone pilot, and in fact, Ian, we're talking about exceptions. The FAA has sort of blessed areas where folks can fly drones without remote ID. And of course, it has an acronym.
These are usually like RC fields.
Yeah, like a radio control remote field. Then they're called FRIAs, F-R-I-A, plural, FRIAs. It's a FAA-recognized identification area. It's a highly monitored airspace area dedicated to drone flight. So if you're going to have fun, you're outside and you want to do drone races and all, you can do it there. And you don't need to have a remote ID registered drone, to my recollection. But the thing is, all Part 107 pilots, like if you are you need to be really wary, especially if you're a full-scale pilot, as drone operators like to call, you know, private pilots and above. You need to have that Part 107 certificate if you're making any kind of money with a drone. Mm-hmm. And they can crack down on that. And if you are subject to a crackdown, the fine could be relatively substantial. It could be, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, Ian. And that's something that the FAA kind of let slide for a while. Mm. But penalties can be up to about $28,000 for flying a drone without remote ID.
Okay. Well, let me put you on the spot for another question.
Sure.
Okay. So you mentioned, now we're going to get down a rabbit hole. So you got to have the 107 if you're making money from it.
Yep.
Now, let's say I'm a real estate agent. I don't own a drone company providing services to real estate agents, but I am the agent, and I've got a drone. If I go up and take pictures of a client's house, do I need a certificate?
That's commercial.
Okay.
Yeah, that's considered commercial for commercial use.
Okay.
Most real estate agents will have a drone operator do the photography and the videography, and then the drone operator, the onus would be on them to make sure that not only would they have a Part 107 certificate, which is like you and I having a private pilot certificate.
Yeah.
But not only that, but your drone needs to be remote ID compliant. So you might ask, yes, what does that mean to be remote ID compliant? What's the whole point of that? Why do you need a drone to broadcast anything? Well, the technology transmits information basically so other people can catch you if you do something wrong.
Yeah,
that's a good way of, you know, describing it.
Yeah.
It gives the UASs or the drones unique ID number, a location, an altitude, a velocity, and a lot more within a certain range. That data, however, Ian, just be advised, it does not include personal identification information. So you would be a number, but you wouldn't be a person.
Okay.
You couldn't be identified as a person unless it went further.
So it's like an N number or an ADS-B number.
It is.
Registration number or something like that.
It is. And okay. You put it on your drone.
Yeah.
Private and public stakeholders can alert the FAA if they hear about unsafe flight operations or anything like that. The other thing that I would like to stress to our Hangar Talk listeners who, you know, dabble in drone flights a little bit. If you have an older drone like I do, you can get an accessory remote ID module. It's a little bitty module, generally USB-C powered with internal battery, and it literally Velcros on top of your drone.
Huh.
But you have to register that. There's an ID number on the side. Register that with the FAA. It's pretty darn simple. I got one off of a major retailer for about $89. And that way I could still fly.
Use an older drone.
Drone versus pitching it in the trash and, you know, buying a new drone.
And no STC required, I guess.
No STC required on that. Good.
That's
point,
good.
Ian.
That's
I like
good.
That.
That's nice.
But I don't fly a drone all that often, but because I am a private pilot and I know you are too, you're a CFI, you know, we want to just play it safe.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point is the FAA is cracking down now. We had some leeway for several months, but now we don't.
Not anymore. Gosh, you know, actually, it takes me on this huge tangent of thinking about who should have the 107. And like, you know, you go to the beach these days, and it's like people are, you know, taking beach videos or of their friends or whatever. And it's like, if you post that on YouTube, I mean, you have the potential to make a couple of bucks, right? Like, that's money.
You can.
Yeah.
And then if it's monetized on YouTube, honestly, Ian, one might be able to make a case that you've monetized it and it's commercial use.
Yeah. Wow.
So be careful, folks.
Okay. Cool. Hey, talking about Tamarack winglets. Now, I think it was just last show we mentioned the NTSB reversal on that Tamarack case, which was a pretty interesting case, pretty landmark, I think, for the NTSB to reverse that. And now, just 2 short weeks later, the FAA has proposed an AD against these winglets. It's relatively minor, has to do with a condition where basically the system can fail and the pilot not know about it.
Right. And that to me is an interesting development that came up, and the company itself noted this.
Yeah.
And got in contact with the FAA. So it is just to put a placard on the panel that says, if this Atlas system fails, the active technology load alleviation system, if it fails, you might not be warned about it. And so it's like another type of enunciator light without it being a light, you know,
right. It's enunciator. Yeah. Placard.
Enunciator.
Yeah. And I think
placard, right.
Yeah. There's a small flight manual update as well. They do say in the proposal that even, you know, a pilot can do this. So my guess is, you know, like you said, this is a proposal. I think they're taking comments through the first week of May. My guess is this will just go through because, as you say, the manufacturer brought up this condition.
It's really just to let people know, hey, you know, keep your head on, like we keep our head on a swivel when we're on VFR flight.
Yeah.
When you have the active winglets engaged, be aware that something might happen and you might not be alerted to it.
Yeah. So. Well, it reminds me of, well, you know this from instrument training. It's like if an old vacuum system fails and you have the old attitude indicator without the flag, it's like you wouldn't know for a couple of minutes, right? You could be following this, you know, attitude indicator that's slowly failing. So it's kind of the same idea. So, yeah.
Yep. Good point, Ian. So we'll see what happens with that. We got to, you know, like you said, folks who fly the Citation jets with the active winglets, you got plenty of time to comment, so do so.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, hey, the National GA Flyover. This is something that we're all really excited about. It's an event that's coming May 11th to downtown Washington, D.C., and live streamed also on YouTube. This is where really the complete history of general aviation will be on display over the nation's capital and for everybody to see around the world on YouTube. We're going to parade more than 60 airplanes down the National Mall and did a little bit of a practice run. David, you were there. How did it go?
It went well. It went well, Ian. We flew out on March the 24th. And we left from Frederick Municipal Airport. There were four aircraft. Now, there'll be 60, you know, when it happens for real. But we headed to the Potomac River. We aimed for a couple of golf courses, and we took a left and went south.
Okay.
And so I was there photographing some of the landmarks on the ground, but also documenting what we did. We had a very, very lengthy pre-flight briefing.
I bet.
Ian, I have never seen that many TSA, Homeland Security, FAA personnel in one spot.
Yeah.
You know, they were crowded into our boardroom. But it shows that there's key interest in this from government agencies. Mm-hmm. They all want it to be safely performed.
Yeah. It's amazing. Actually, you bring up, before we go on, the amount of coordination that this takes. I mean, this has been like at least a year in planning.
Yeah.
And Congress had to get involved. And then you get, you know, like you said, all these people from all these different agencies have to sign off on it. They have to have their say. I know two Secret Service agents flew with Mark Baker in the caravan, right? Because he led the flight of four.
Uh-huh.
So it's an incredible amount of coordination and work that goes into it.
It is. And you know, what's interesting, you know, we had all these personnel, and they arrived on a Sunday morning. So that's a pretty big commitment for folks in government. But we had a great flight. It went off without a hitch. I don't want to leave people, you know, with a hanging chad there. It went off without a hitch. So the flight is set for May 11th. It's a Saturday. And there's a rain date of the next day, which is Mother's Day. But May 10th, there's going to be a little bit of a gathering at AOPA to help celebrate the 85th anniversary, as you mentioned, Ian. And the flyover sort of highlights the culmination of general aviation, the decades where we start with the golden age, we go through the boom decades, we go through, you know, the explosive growth decades, and we have some, we're planning to have just 60 some odd aircraft. There's only going to be two formation flights because formation is generally strictly prohibited over the National Mall. A group of Vans aircraft will fly in formation, and the Titan Aviation team, formerly Aeroshell, will fly in a diamond formation, picking up the rear. So that will be interesting.
That's you think about that over the mall, that noise, you know, you get from the T-6s, that is something else. That's very cool.
Yeah. We flew at about 1,000 feet over the mall, basically a route from Frederick. You go to the Potomac River, you take a left, you follow the river, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right down. Easy.
All the way down to Roslyn, Virginia, some of the high rises there, and you turn left. There's a bridge that actually leads right into the Washington Monument, and that's in the area of P-56, which is a restricted area. We're a little bit south of P-56. We're a little bit away from it. And we take a hard right over the Smithsonian, they call it the castle, Ian.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You take a hard right so we avoid the Capitol building itself. And after we take that hard right, then it's our flight basically over the mall is over, and it's a return to base up to Frederick. It was great. It was a beautiful blue sky day. And I was flying in Mike Ginter's Bonanza A36 model. Mike is our airport's VP, basically, and also runs the airport support network. And he's a formation qualified pilot. And so we flew with him in the open door Bonanza. It was a lot of fun. And we just had a good time. Mark Baker, like you said, led the flight.
Awesome.
And did a perfect right turn over the castle and set the tone really for what we hope to be a safe, successful, interesting DC flyover that celebrates general aviation on May 11th.
Yep. Awesome. So if you can't be in DC, which most folks won't, you can watch it on YouTube live when it happens. We'll do another reminder as the next show as it gets close. Definitely back in that Saturday morning. And we'll be right back. Hey, David, I got a riddle for you. How can you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your airplane?
I think upgrading the pilot would be the first clue for that one.
The guy between the headsets, huh? Yeah.
That's right.
All right. That's not what I'm talking about, but I'll give you a clue. It has ADS-B traffic and weather, Sirius XM weather and entertainment, no wires, and it works with 4Flight and Garmin Pilot.
Oh, Ian, I know what that is. It's the Garmin GDL52 Sirius XM portable weather receiver.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And now, believe it or not, the Garmin GDL52 comes with a 3-month trial of Sirius XM aviation weather and a very special limited time $400 rebate. Learn more about all that this receiver can do and the limited time $400 rebate by visiting sporties.com/GDL52. David, mental health, it's an issue that I think a lot of us are maybe familiar with, even if we haven't experienced it directly, and that is essentially the FAA's reluctance to certify folks with mental health challenges, whether they're being treated or not. And so the FAA formed an aviation rulemaking committee, which is a sort of an official process that the FAA goes through before they make big changes.
Mm-hmm.
They've been meeting over the last couple of months, and they've already put out a report. This is going to be a very important report as the FAA moves forward on this. It was 165 pages or something.
Yeah.
With some really interesting conclusions, I think.
Well, the other thing about it is that it was sort of a joint report. There were several different groups that got together, as you were starting to mention, the FAA's Office of Aerospace Medicine, FAA Flight Standards Office, the NTSB, academia, grassroots aviation advocacy groups, our folks all got involved.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that's come up time and time again is ADHD.
Yeah.
And they addressed this. The committee suggested evaluating the possibility of allowing pilots and controllers diagnosed with ADHD to use appropriate and approved medications while on duty. And the reason why that's important is that I want to say maybe it was like 20, 30 years ago, it was really quick for medical professionals to diagnose someone with attention deficit disorder.
Yeah.
And it kind of drew a line in the sand in case you wanted to be a professional pilot later on.
Made it much harder.
And, our pilot information folks and our medical personnel at AOPA have been working with folks that have had that diagnosis for quite some time. So this group addressed that, and there's more to come on that, but there at least is a group looking into that.
Yeah. I agree. That was a big deal. The other big deals are essentially creating a time period by which people can, in a non-punitive way, a pathway, they can disclose their mental health condition. So basically, it's sort of like a, you know, an acknowledgement where everybody says, okay, we know this has been an issue. We know people have been avoiding what they put on the medical application form for fear of reprisals, you know?
Right.
So it's like, okay, for whatever period, tell us everything you got. You're not going to get in trouble for not telling us before. So they recommended that, which I think is smart.
Yeah.
The other thing that I thought was a big deal is they talked about allowing with, I think, you know, presumably with not even deferring the medical application, about allowing talk therapy. So this whole concern that people have about going to marriage therapy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or yes, you know, stress stuff. Yeah.
We have talked about that ourselves.
Yep, that would all be okay.
So the stigma associated with that would be something that you would not want to put typically on your medical application.
Mm-hmm.
So this, you're right, Ian, the stigma with that, making that stigma go away would be huge because folks sometimes might need some talk therapy, you know, in case of a death of a loved one or sort of a PTSD type thing. Say you saw an aircraft accident and it really traumatized you, then you would want to talk through that and learn a little bit more about what could happen after that. The someone who loses a loved one, the five stages of grief, mm-hmm. you know, so there's a lot of room for that. And there's a lot more to come on that.
Yes.
One thing that I was going to let our listeners know, we didn't tell them yet, but this was just not one meeting. This is a series of at least three different, you know, weeks of meetings.
Yes.
And going back and forth and back and forth and multiple times each week, you know, these groups met. That's a big commitment.
Oh, it is. And I think, you know, these ARC programs, for folks who haven't kind of watched the, you know, how the sausage is made, I mean, these things can take years. It's like when the FAA forms an ARC, it can take a very long time between deciding that they're going to do it and getting the final report. And this has been extremely fast. I mean, I think they just brought it up just a few months ago. And so for them to be able to meet, come to a consensus, and that's the other thing about this, you know, we say like, can't, you know, like the system doesn't work anymore and politics and can't everybody get along. This is a system where it was like every voting member of this group, and they are, as you mentioned, widely diverse. I mean, airlines, GA, flight training, like you said, academia, mental health professionals, there's somebody from the Mayo Clinic, they all agreed on the recommendations of this report. So mm-hmm. that's, you know, that shows that we all sort of recognize that the system is broken and needs some major changes.
Well, it also shows a good and very positive leadership by the FAA Federal Air Surgeon, Dr. Susan Northrop, a pilot,
yeah.
you know, and she's pretty visible usually at AirVenture and some other big events. So I think that she probably has a little bit more of a handle on this than maybe perhaps other administrators might have had, you know, in the past, other flight surgeons.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's a key thing. And she said she was going to attack this and jump on it and try to change things. And it sure looks like she has.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, hey, let's finish off today talking about Vans, the makers, of course, of all the RV airplanes, and their plan to climb out of bankruptcy, which has just been going on for a few months now. We know that they went into bankruptcy protection to be able to, they were hemorrhaging money because of some parts that weren't manufactured very well. And now there is a final plan that's been presented to the court. It still needs to be approved, but it includes a huge chunk of cash, David.
It does.
Yeah, from the company founder.
Yeah, you know, Dick Van himself and his wife chipped in $7 million in secured loans, and that was to allow the company to keep operating, if you will. And the company has vowed to remain open, keep the doors open, and continue to work hard, quote unquote, to serve our customers. And it sure looks like they're going to do that. The largest group of unsecured creditors, Ian, and I hope I'm reading this correctly from Jim Moore's story, is a group of folks who decided they wanted to just throw in the towel. And they had already put down a deposit, but they decided, well, the prices have gone up and I'm not sure I want to support, you know, the company any longer. Well, the company proposes prioritizing the first $3,350 of purchase deposits in that group. They otherwise would be treated as unsecured claims, which yeah. it means you would be way, way, way down the bankruptcy repayment list.
Yeah.
But that was a small group of folks. The majority of people have stuck with Vans
yeah.
and have just said, yep, we're in it for the long haul. These are really, you know, we love the kits. It's a great company. We're going to help make it happen.
Yeah. It has been interesting, I think, when you see essentially the goodwill that Vans has been given to climb out of this bankruptcy issue. I mean, people, I've been actually really surprised by it, despite the fact that these kits, for the people who accepted the price increase, which, as you mentioned, is the vast majority, I think it's like 82%, basically.
Right.
You're talking about a 30% increase in prices here. I mean, that's not insignificant, right?
It's 30 to 50% yeah. increases, depending on the componentry. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that I do think that is interesting, despite the fact that the company obviously made a mistake in the manufacturing of these parts. And I guess people are in, right? They say, this is the airplane I want. They're going to accept that price increase and keep going. The question remains, what's going to happen to those who didn't accept, as you said, that price increase? But yeah, we'll have to see if the court accepts it. But so far, all things are looking good for a quick exit.
Well, I'm excited to hear about Vans, you know, emerging from bankruptcy protection. Ian, honestly, they're not the only company, aircraft manufacturing company, that has faced that. You know, mm-hmm. a loyal Hangar Talk listeners will know that I used to fly a Mooney. They had multiple bankruptcies. Heck, Piper, I think, way back when yeah. had some trouble as well.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about Cessna or Textron Beechcraft. I just haven't checked into it.
Mooney is the poster child, though, aren't they? Poor Mooney.
They are.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but so there's precedent for this.
Yes.
And the folks who fly vans
just recently, right?
Oh, right. Yeah. And you're more familiar with Enstrom. Absolutely. We've written about that a few times. I'm wondering still what's going to happen with the RV15 kit that Vans unveiled a couple of air ventures ago. I wonder if they'll keep that in-house or will they sell that design to someone else, you know, to help get some more money together. Jim Story says that 8 kits currently offered on the company website include the RV15.
Yeah.
So it's the first high-wing design.
Yeah, it seems like it's going forward. Absolutely. So,
okay.
Yeah, we wish them the best. Okay. Hey, David, so another kit mentor, and in this case, it's the individual, right? Because they're making all the parts, and that's Carlo and Rick. So a really cool story about building similar airplanes at similar times and using the help of each other to make it happen.
How did this get started and what was the premise for building two side by side?
Well, I had finished my last project about 3 or 4 years ago, my Mustang II, and decided to do something totally different philosophy of building and flying. And I heard it was a difficult project because why make something easy? And not too long after sort of mulling the project out, Rick and I have known each other for a long time, and Rick said, you know, I've always wanted to do a home build. This sounds like an intriguing one. Let's collaborate.
What was the process like of doing it side by side? Was there an advantage to doing it?
Oh, definitely an advantage. The learning curve on making one part was pretty steep. And then as you continue to make more parts, it was easier and easier and easier. So say like, you know, as opposed to making 4 wings, we made 8 wings. And the first wing took quite a while. The last wing went pretty fast.
And when you say quite a while and pretty fast, what does that mean?
Well, you can't really say this wing took a month to put together because it's consistent of a lot of ribs and each rib took a day to make. So it's kind of hard to say, you know, that like it took, but once we had all the ribs together and the spars cut and things like that, it seems to me it took a month to get that first one together and it took days to do the last one, just a few days.
Yeah, definitely. And learning all the tricks, especially the wood forming tricks and everything else, and That was definitely advantageous. And the fixturing, you know, we had to make little special tools along the way. And the more process relies on a special tool, the more beneficial it is to use and utilize it twice.
And how did you divide up the responsibilities and divide up the tasks?
We sort of subspecialized. Rick's more of a woodworker, and I'm more of a metal person. And Rick's got some really good woodworking equipment, professional grade stuff that would normally be aluminum table saw, and he's got a cast iron table saw. It's really professional grade stuff. And there were certain things that I'd never heard of in woodworking, like, you know, joining processes that just made so much sense. And Rick came up with these router bits that I've never seen before, and they worked perfectly, and they made the process easy. And a wood wing is not easy to do, and there's so many variations in the way the things fit. So yeah, getting the process down and getting this, especially for the ribs, getting an assembly line down was really important and really streamlined things.
And how about the whole process? How long did it take?
Start to finish on Rick's plane is a month or two behind, but 4.5 years, so 4.5 to 5 years total each aircraft. I can't tell you how many hours. We never really kept a good track of that, but thousands of hours. And yeah, it was a lot of time, but it was all enjoyable. It really was. There were frustrating moments, but it was all really fun. And I enjoyed there's definitely new skills I learned, new skills Rick learned. The sheet metal was, you know, the English wheel forming was the most challenging for me because I had to compound form all these aluminum sheets. And that was probably the most complex and the most daunting task for me. And learning-wise, the woodwork was actually, I think the woodwork was the most fun. It's not the cleanest because there's always chips and shavings, but when you're working with steel and aluminum, the chips and shavings are kind of nasty and they're sharp, and the wood, it's sort of a benign, fun, smells good. The woods have lovely smells to them, and each one is, I think, 7 to 9 different kinds of wood in this aircraft, and they're all fun to work with.
Putting it together, yeah. I mean, the assembly is a lot of fun. I mean, the challenge of trying to keep, plan things out so they work is, Carla did a great job on that. I mean, we have very few remakes of anything, very few things that we go, oh, yeah, this is going to work out perfect, and then you get it together, and it's, like, completely wrong. Very few of those. It's happened, and it's going to happen at a project like that. But, yeah, it's, I've learned a lot about metalwork and, you know, the shrinkage and, you know, and stretching of it. And
imagine you learn a lot about the person you're working with, too. What did you learn about each other?
Ginger beer.
Yeah, I do like ginger beer. I got fed a lot of that. But Rick's pleasant to work with, you know. I wouldn't have embarked on this journey with him if I didn't think he was going to be pleasant to work with. And I've known him for a while, and obviously, you know, it's a working relationship. So you really get to see someone's thought patterns, you know, how they decide what's good and what's bad in the process, and it sort of reflects their personality. And especially, you know, Rick has got a very good aesthetic eye for, you know, the beautiful veneers that we went into the glove boxes. He did research on that, and we bonded it, and it looks really good. A lot of aesthetic touches, which I didn't think I wouldn't have been able to nail down, he got, and it looks good.
Yeah, but the parts going together, I mean, the sheet metal and stuff like that, the curves really make the airplane, like the speed ring is just phenomenal.
And we decided on a lot of things that I may not have nailed down the look of something. And we decided together on, this is how we're going to shape this, how the shape is going to flow into the next thing. And I said to Rick, how about this? You know, do you think that'd look good? And we never really, you know, there's obviously the different colors of the aircraft like that, but the structure and the, there's very few differences that are structural or sheet metal wise. They're pretty much all the same.
Yeah. You know, some of the key decision points were the glass panel and the round engine. What went into those decisions?
The glass panel, I think, was a no-brainer because it's in this airspace environment we're in. We really thought, we kept on thinking, you know, the hats purists are going to disown us because they like round gauges, and here we come with EFIS. But really, it looks neater. It really, instead of a smattering of round engine gauges everywhere sort of sneezed onto the panel randomly, you've got a neat, clean, square display, and it's not much bigger than a COM radio.
And cost.
Yeah.
And reliability. It actually costs less than the reliability, weight.
So the technical aspect was a no-brainer. The social, you know, but we're not here to please the hats purists. We're here to please us. So we made that decision early on that EFIS was going to be a good decision. And the round engine was purely emotional. It was not a practical decision at all. It was the romance of a round engine. The Rotec was available, and there were several people had put this engine in hats classics. And we looked at fixtures and we said, this is it. This is, you know, it's not a yet another Lycoming. And it presented challenges, but it does look good. And yeah, that's a purely an emotional decision.
Yeah, and that was probably the biggest selling point for me to build the airplane too. Is, yeah, you get an airplane with a round engine. I mean, a Waco is out of my price range. Stearmans are not that fun to fly, and they're expensive. This seemed to have a characteristic that was easy to fly. The expense of it was within reach. Just have to put it together, have to build it, which was part of the thing too, is never built an airplane before, and now I could say I've built an airplane.
And what is it like to fly? Carlo, you've flown yours.
It's totally different. I've never flown an airplane that's blind on landing, so that's very new to me. But it's a very easy airplane to fly, I think. And it's pleasant to fly. And most people, I'm not experienced enough to make comparative analyses, but I think everyone who's got a lot of time in the Hats Classics say it's basically a Super Cub. And the Hats CB1, which is the older, smaller version, is basically same as a J3 Cub in handling and speeds and everything else. But I enjoy it. It's been fun. You know, I typically always sort of dread the 40-hour fly-off period because, you know, you're just sort of sitting there testing out things, and it's not really supposed to be fun, but it turned out to be fun. It's as I dialed the airplane in, it became better and better and more fun to fly. And now it's a totally hands-off airplane, and its handling is very nice.
And what are your plans for the future of it? Are you gonna go places together? It's not really a cross-country plane. What are your plans on how to utilize the airplane now that it's finished?
Give lots of rides.
Yeah.
I think it's gonna be a real hit in hopping rides department. And I've got a laundry list of people that already have signed up for a ride. And it's sort of, you know, because it doesn't go fast and because it's got a neat sound and a neat flight experience, it's really, the only downside of hopping rides in the plane like this is it's cumbersome to get in and out of the front cockpit. But the upside is it's a heck of an experience. And the fact that people spend a lot of money on a ride in a Waco tells you that it's a cool experience.
I'd like to take it to air shows. I mean, some of the local ones.
Especially ones on grass.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Sentimental Journey would be a blast in this thing.
Yeah, my previous home built, the Mustang II, has never landed on grass in its life before, probably never will. It's a totally different experience, and I missed out on a lot of small grass strip fly-ins because of that, so this ought to be, and it should be a head-turner.
How about any surprises along the way? What have been the things that stick out in your mind as maybe not going precisely according to plan?
Oil leaks,
lots of oil leaks.
Major oil leaks, not minor ones. Not radial engine oil leaks, major oil leaks.
But we've got it nailed down. I think we've got and that's part of the experimental experience is you figure out the problem and you fix it. And the same thing with structural or aerodynamic problems, you figure it out and hopefully not structural to where something breaks, but certainly you have to just dial it in and figure out what, you know, how to improve something that. The problem with a plane like this is it's already finished, so you can. It's very hard to make major changes because it's painted from the outset. But luckily, I haven't had to do that, and so that's good.
Now, when you were doing this process, I remember you had the option to buy an upholstered, you know, buy upholstery or do the upholstery yourself, and you decided to do it because that's something you hadn't ever done before. What's the attraction of doing things you hadn't done before?
I think it was cheap. I don't know. And it was a challenge. It's one again, this airplane is attractive because it is hard to build. And upholstery is always something that boggled my mind. And how do people do that? And so I looked at it's certainly not a showpiece, but I looked at a lot of YouTube videos and said, I think I can try and do this. And it's about 80% of a showpiece, I think. There's definite flaws in it, but it was a fun thing to do too. It was a wintertime project and it was too cold to do a lot of work on the airplane. So off to the basement and I bought myself an industrial sewing machine and went at it. I bought, you know, it took about two hides. Each aircraft took two hides to do the upholstery.
How about you, Rick? I mean, do you approach things the same way that it's like the unknown is attractive because you haven't, because it's novel?
No, I think it's a little bit different. I like to know how things work before I do it. But, you know, in order to get things done, you do have to challenge yourself. You have to mix things up a bit. And this is a huge part of mixing things up.
So you're flying the airplane to Oshkosh, right?
Yep.
So what are you hoping to do with the airplane to Oshkosh?
I'm going to enter it in judging, but I'm just going to, you know, and share it with the flying community and polish it and be there to answer questions and mix up with my new hats community that I'm part of. I was part of the Mustang community, and I have two dinners to go to, but you know, and the adventure is going to be, I'm going to take a good dear friend of mine to Oshkosh, and we're going to, you know, make a nice adventure out of getting there. And that's going to be half the fun. And then showing the airplane off will be the other half.
The first flight of this airplane didn't go exactly as planned. What was that about?
So what happened is there was an oil seal behind the engine pressure oil pump. This thing has three oil pumps, but the pressure pump has a seal. And it happened to fail and spew, I think, 6 quarts of oil in a scope of 6 minutes while Dave was flying. And we saw an oil streak. And part of me said, oh, radial engine, it smokes. Maybe there's some nooks and crannies that oil was hiding in before that it's, you know. And part of me should have just said, no, let's stop and see what's going on. But I said, oh, it'll stop. And And then Dave took off and flew, and I said, this is a proper smoke trail. It's half the thickness of an aerobatic air show smoke trail. And luckily, you know, someone had primed me on the fact that air show smoke uses an insane amount of oil to do that. So I said, this plane is using an insane amount of oil. Let's get Dave on the ground right now. And we landed, we had 2 quarts of oil left. So that was exciting. And yeah, we fixed that and we had a recurrence of the problem. So I did a modification to the oil pump that actually relieves all the pressure on that seal. And it's basically inlet pressure of the pump instead of outlet pressure. And it's been bone dry ever since. It's not a common occurrence with the engine. The engine's been reasonably reliable. And some people have had issues with the engine. It's just like any aircraft engine. And some people have had zero. And parts of the aircraft of this engine, they're built like a Swiss watch. It's really beautiful.
And how about the propeller? Where does that come from?
That's an MT from Germany. And it just happened to show up at the right time. All the timing was good with it. And it was made, we got in contact with MT in DeLand, Florida, and they said, yes, we know that propeller model, and we'll get with the folks in Germany. And they got the ball rolling, and we actually had 3 props made at the same time, which helped, sort of a bulk purchase. But the prop and engine both are absolute works of art, and the prop is very light, and it's finished like a Stradivarius violin. It's just absolutely beautiful.
Is there any part that you're the most proud of, or is it just the whole thing in its entirety?
The whole thing. I think the speed ring was the most difficult, and it sets the airplane apart. I think that was the most challenging one of all. I think it's probably the thing I'm most proud of.
Rick, is your airplane going to have the same speed ring?
Don't know yet, for sure.
it'll have the
same. It's in progress.
It's close. It's about 80% done.
Oh, it is? Okay, great. I need to come over and work on that some, probably.
So, Carlo, what was it like? What was the feeling like when you flew the airplane for the first time?
Oh, scary, scary. I got the numbers from Dave and flew them. But it's luckily it's an easy airplane. It's just such a different sight picture. It's blind, and then also the gear is so tall that wheel landing seems to be the way to go, because you just have to feel and to hit the runway a little before you expect it every time. And even when you're more used to it, it still happens before you expect it. But it's a benign airplane. It's draggy for sure. And you can carry a lot of power into the landing, and it'll still land.
So did you have a chance to think about the accomplishment part of flying much, or were you mostly just like thinking about the flying the airplane?
I treated it like it was some other airplane on the flight line that I was just getting checked out in and getting used to. And I couldn't, because when you're boarding an airplane, you think about every weld and, I've got to do this right. And I've got every little glue joint, and you can't possibly, think about all those little things that could possibly fail that you built. You built this in the house. It's not a controlled environment. It's not a factory. There's no quality. There's no quality standard, and there's no manual, and there's no quality control department. You do it all. You're the taxpayer in this program. You're the program manager. You're everything. And all that has to just go out of your mind, and you're flying this new airplane. But it's cool, and it's, without Dave's encouragement, I would have never gotten it.
But it's true, though. I mean, if you think about how much work went into it, and how much is at stake, and how much all that stuff would be out the window if you messed it up. It's like you'd never take off.
No, you wouldn't. Like, you've just got to treat it like some other airplane. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it is. It is a lot of work that you're carrying on your shoulder, but you just don't think about it. You become a pilot. You take the mechanic and fabricator hat off, and you put the pilot hat on, and you go fly an airplane.
And is the enjoyment of the flying experience different in an airplane that you built?
Yes, I think it is more enjoyable. It is definitely more enjoyable because you've customized the plane to your standards. You buy a factory airplane, and it's geared towards the masses. And it does everything quite well, but I wanted this thing here. I wanted the comm radio here. I wanted the switches here. Everything's the ergonomics. It's custom made. It's a Rolls Royce made for me, by me.
I'm I'm glad you mentioned Carlos Lindy, because it is an unbelievably beautiful airplane. I mean, it's a specimen for sure.
It's gorgeous. And both of those guys, I mean, they learned how to do fabric and upholstery work. They laced leather. They did all kinds of things, and they did it together. But can you imagine 8 wings? I mean, building 8 wings, yeah. That's some kind of camaraderie. No,
I can't imagine building 1 wing, you know, much less 8.
But they did a great job. One is red, one is blue. They're both gorgeous and 4 years in the making. That's just fantastic for Carlo and for Rick.
It is. Yep. Hey, that's all the time we have. I'm Ian Twombly. Our editor is Austin Hansen.
And I'm David Tulis. Don't forget, you can find us at aopa.org/hangertalk and wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. We'll see you, David.
See you, Ian.
Hangar Talk from AOPA, your freedom to fly.